Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Tuesday night installment here at Your Remedy is in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various IRS administrative remedies with our speaker, Mr. Tony Davis. My name is Martin Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedy is in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer.
Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedy is in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. If you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless, and it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedy is in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com, if we look up in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure. Better known to some as American jurisprudence or ANJUR, the rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course, so it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Although these items are very affordably priced, the jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedy is in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of yourremedyisinthelaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedy is in the Law. And Your Remedy is in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that all together make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at yourremedyisinthelaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you get to a point where it will ask you what are your hot points interested in. This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights, anything that you can think of. But if it affects your personal rights, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much of what you think of a network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom. It's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think that they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. Maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do were I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look up these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to the point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people to start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. You're over the road. You don't want to deal with the call process. Maybe you're just new to your remedies in the law, and you don't yet have your username and password. Therefore, you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night, the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. And there's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make if your remedy is in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at your remedy is in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that honestly most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. Can we make those introductions? Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. But we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if your remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you call board and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it.
Well, Martin, I want to thank you very much for that disclaimer that you've offered us this evening, and it's very appreciated. Ladies and gentlemen, tonight, I think that John is going to be a little bit late. I know that wheels touched down at an airport near him about 23 minutes ago, according to what the schedule should be. So I'm expecting that I'll be talking to you for probably another 30 minutes, maybe less. He will be on the call tonight. What he's going to talk about is a matter of, for those of you who have written legal papers before, filings, briefs, motions, whatever, this really is targeted for you. For those of you that have never written a thing, then it's something to sit back and listen to, because it's going to one day you're going to most likely engage with the team, and it's good that you have this understanding ahead of time. You've heard the expression, less is more. I hope you have. In that expression, we learn that, you know, people, they put their makeup on, and some of them really go crazy with putting their makeup on, and, you know, for heaven's sake, they look like streetwalkers when they're done, or trans women trying to make themselves look pretty, whatever it is. Point being is that we fellows, when we look at women, we appreciate in their beauty and their makeup when less is more, when it's done to highlight and accentuate perhaps, but, you know, less is more, less is better. So with that as a backdrop, in writing your motions and your briefs and so forth, and your motions particularly, less is better. Less is more. An example, the first inclination of anyone when they're writing a motion is they want to put the whole kitchen sink into it, everything that relates. When in truth and reality, the only thing, and you've got this judge's attention for just a moment, that's all. Judges are going to be very weary of their time, if you would, and very, very covetous of their time. So when you come in with 30 or 40 pages of a well-written motion, you're just going to get little attention, probably not even read, maybe one or two pages, and that's about it. So what do you always want to do? You always want to keep your motions to one or two pages, if you can, and you can usually. In, I took debate in high school. I was in a debate club. No jokes about me being a master at what I was doing. I took debate, and one of the first things that you learned was when the opposing party was making their presentation or whatever it was that they were going to base their facts upon or talk about, they made certain assertions, and you would write those assertions down. And oftentimes there was only two or three assertions in the entire debate on whatever the subject was, sometimes four, sometimes five, very, very, just a couple usually. So when you had your opportunity for your three-minute rebuttal, you wanted to focus on those two or three or four points that they made and give counterpoints to them and make your counterpoints more thorough, if you would, and very succinct as possible, because the judge is, again, in a debate, just as a judge in a courtroom, is you have limited amount of time to have their attention. So with that in mind, I'm going to share with you. Let me see if he's on the call tonight. No, I don't see him. Okay, good. We'll talk about him behind his back. No, just kidding. Remember Nicholas. If you've been on these calls in the past, and you have, I see everybody on this call on calls in the past. You know that we talked about Nicholas and his situation where he was traveling around Arizona. The local PD declared that his taillight was defective, and they pulled him over. They didn't like his attitude, and frankly, I probably would not have liked his attitude either, because he knows the limits of a law enforcement officer and what they may or may not do. And they had, you know, just overwhelmingly breached any duty that they had in the process. So his communications with them could have been a whole lot different, and in all likelihood could have resulted in just a ticket for the taillight or a warning, even just to get it fixed possibly. But these deputies were trained to go on a hunt and look for what they deemed to be criminal activity, utilizing an infraction, which, you know, a taillight is an infraction. Doing 100 miles an hour in a 70-mile-an-hour zone is an infraction. It's not a crime. Point being is that the officers took that opportunity. They said, well, we want to search your car. And he says, not unless you have a court order, a warrant, or a judgment. And then goes, well, we're going to place you under arrest. We're going to impound your car, and we need to take an inventory of what's inside your car. So that was their egress to come into it. And when they were going through the glove box, they found a Ziploc bag with two-year-old, three-year-old, possibly longer-aged mushrooms that are meant to be consumed for psychotropic value. And then in the back seat of the car, in properly contained enclosures, they found a semi-automatic pistol, and they found a semi-automatic rifle. And they deemed them all illegal. And they deemed the bag that it was in, the baggie, to be drug paraphernalia. And the guy is looking at 20 to 30 years. Okay? So their first was a motion to dismiss, and it was based upon this. In that motion to dismiss, it was established the political citizenship status, because it had been corrected as an American national. So that right there took everything off the board. You can get as high as you want as an American national. You can be publicly drunk if you want as an American national. The list goes endless. As long as you don't hurt someone or their property, you're good to go. However, all of the points in the first motion to dismiss were totally ignored by the prosecutor, and a rehearing was set. Last week, that hearing took place, and a second motion to dismiss was put in place. And I'm going to share with you that there were three. Let me just double check, make sure it's not four. You got count one, count two, count three. Yeah, there were three criminal counts. Placed against this young man. And the teams teach this material, which, surprisingly, Nicholas made some corrections and then filed it perfectly. There's always corrections to be made, always, and the reason for that is that the author of anything that's used as a teaching syllabus to begin with has to always end up as the product of the student, not the teacher. We're very careful not to practice law without a license, so we teach and provide teaching material. So the entire motion to dismiss, the second motion to dismiss, this one from last week, if you take away the court style, and the court style is where you've got your name and contact information, your phone number, your email, and then underneath that is the actual court style where it goes into, you know, who the parties are, what this motion is about, who the judge is, and so forth. And then, you know, it's the comes now, and it just leads you into saying, hello, this is what we're talking about. You get rid of page one, and you have on page two, count one, and then on page three, you have count two and count three and the conclusion. And then on page four is the prayer and the certificate of service to share this writing with concerned. So, and also understand the entirety of this is double-spaced, okay? You know, double-spaced has got big spaces between each line, each sentence, each line of the page. So you really could have condensed all of this without the court style and without the certificate of service. You could, in normal writing, it all fit on one page. So with a double space, it simply was reduced to the smallest amount that you could possibly put on there and rebut every point that the prosecutor was relying upon. Count, you know, so you have point and counterpoint, just like in debate. So count one, this is talking about the semi-automatic pistol and the semi-automatic rifle that they discovered they illegally, without a court order, warrant, or judgment, simply working off of something called policy, which is not law. When they entered the car, they found these under a blanket in properly contained holsters, etc., and they charged him with the firearms. So anyways, it's count one. The Second Amendment to the Constitution of the United States makes it very clear, quote, the right to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, end quote. Arizona statute section 13-3101, 3102A8, 34-01, 34-7-01, 13-702, and 13-801 all infringe upon an individual's right to keep and bear arms and therefore are all void as per the Supreme Court of the United States decision in Marbury versus Madison, 1803, 5 U.S. 1, Cranch 179. Nowhere in the Constitution / Bill of Rights does it exclude or prohibit the defendant from exercising defendant's inalienable right to keep and bear a firearm in defendant's truck or this courtroom. Furthermore, federal statutes 18 U.S.C. 241 and 18 U.S.C. 242 make it a felony in the second degree and potentially a felony in the first degree, a capital crime, which means death upon conviction, to even attempt to exercise any of the aforementioned statutes. Article 3, Section 1, Line 2 of the Constitution states, quote, the judge, both of the supreme and inferior courts, shall hold their office in times of good behavior, end quote. Thus, making it very clear there's no such thing as judicial immunity, let alone prosecutorial immunity. The Supreme Court of the United States in Shore versus Rhodes, 416 U.S. 232. This is a 1974 decision. 94 South Court, 1687, said, furthermore, a statute that would attempt to conjugate the legal and lawful constitution possession of a firearm with any other potential crime is also void. Therefore, one must fail. This is the end of the first page, double-spaced, in response to the charges against him. Count two. In light of the fact that this is addressing the magic mushrooms, in light of the fact that the prosecutor has less than 1/50th of the threshold amount as required by Arizona Revised Statute 13-13-1-36J to proceed with prosecution on count two, the possession of psilocybin, count two must also fail. Count three. Prosecutor, her name, references Arizona Revised Statutes, Section 13-34-1, 13-34-7, 13-34-15A, 13-34-18, 13-1, 13-7-2, and 13-8-1, a class 6 felony regarding drug paraphernalia. Yet, no Arizona Revised Statute defines that C.S. Johnson & Son Incorporated, the commercial product manufacturer called Ziploc, brands bags as drug paraphernalia. Therefore, count three must fail. Conclusion. There is no Arizona Revised Statutes that make either a failed taillight nor the perceived willful failure to present identification arrestable offenses. Quote, that fact is circumstance to be considered in determining whether, in first instance, there was probable cause for the arrest, end quote. Monroe versus Papa, D.C., Illinois, 1963, 221 F. Sup. 685. There was no probable cause for arresting the defendant. The perception of a bad attitude by the defendant asking questions of the servant of the people, the officer of the law, is not grounds for arrest and cannot be construed as such. Thus ends the second page of double space in the rebuttal to the charges filed by the prosecutor. And then the third page is just three lines. Prayer. Wherefore, premises considered, defendant moves to have all charges counts be dismissed, defendant's record be expunged for this arrest, and defendant's possessions and bail be returned to defendant. See how that all worked out? Short, sweet, compact, to the point. The judge read that in literally probably half the time or a quarter of the time that I took to share this with you, and that gave the bench all that time because the team reduced everything to the smallest expression possible. The smallest expression possible. So with that, it is my pleasure to turn this call over to Brother John. Go ahead, buddy.
Now, by the way, I'm still on the airplane. We're texting in, and so I'm not going to be able to participate fully yet for a few minutes. But real quick, I've seen some excellent briefs in support of the motion. I've seen some excellent trial briefs. I've seen some unbelievable appellate briefs, appellees briefs, and reply briefs. And the more I see in my few short 50-some-odd years that I've been doing this, I've come to realize that short and sweet and simple is good. We had I don't know if Michael shared with you, but we had a situation where, just recently where it appears the judge, we boiled down, after some encouragement, 27 pages of writing a text, not including the style certificate of service and the prayer, we boiled it down to 2.5, almost 3 pages. And we boiled each of the critical points. These are issues involved around federal criminal grand jury indictments. And Judge, one of them is only 6 lines long, but apparently he scanned it just enough to realize that there was some question. And we asked questions. We find that distilling something down to the lowest common denominator, less words is possible. And if you can ask thought-provoking questions so that the prosecutor or the judge or your opponent in a civil case realizes, wait a minute, holy shit, that man, I was wrong. If you ask the question, causes them to ask so that you don't have to tell them, then what happens is that you've won them over, and it's the judge, the jury, or the prosecutor, you've gone even farther, and especially if it's a case involving criminal, like a grand jury indictment, and the prosecutor realizes you ask the right question. The prosecutor asks himself, whoa, this person's right. Why aren't we prosecuting them? Then a lot of the, Alan, she's one to point to, and everybody likes to point to. I'll use it to withdraw myself right now. This prosecution against those exercising their Second Amendment rights to keep and bear a firearm. And we talked about this question multiple times. But, Your Honor, may I check? Where in the Constitution does it excuse my right to keep and bear a firearm in that school ground or that restaurant, let alone this court? And, or Mr. Prosecutor, where in the Constitution is issued my right hand. If we look at this 18 receipts opposed to Mr. Prosecutor, could you look at that, please? Is it the court's opinion or your opinion that that would constitute a felony of the second degree? Because it says under color of law, and it's saying that there is law out there that is unconstitutional, that is not right, not correct. And to the U.S. Supreme Court decision dating back to 1803, Marbury versus Madison, first branch, 179. You guys can look that up, get that off the recording. Actually, you just do a web search on Google or any one of those, just Marbury versus Madison, you pull it up. Scroll down to the last page of the opinion, 179. There, the second from the last sentence says, any law repugnant to the Constitution is void. And that also goes for Supreme Court, even Supreme Court decisions, if they're repugnant to the Constitution, they're void. And so much for the lower court decisions. Now, sometimes if you have an effect like a painful tooth, you put some lotion on there, some all different kinds of lotions and potions on your tooth. Maybe even put a little lidocaine in there and numb the pain. That doesn't cure the problem. The reason you have a toothache is because you have an infection. And what's happened is the body is surrounded. The infection, it sends some special forces to go after the bad guys. And they're called white blood cells. They establish a perimeter, a membrane around the toxins or the intruder. They establish a perimeter and fill it with white blood cells with special forces, black brave, green brave. That's what white blood cells are. But as they expand inside that membrane, they push on the nerve. And you get this ache. You get pain just pushing on the nerve. And sometimes pulling the tooth will drain that pustule or that injury, something you call it zit. But if you take an antibiotic or you take like colloidal silver, gargle with it, and give me but until after it goes away. Same exact thing is true in law. We can put a salve on the problem or a lotion or potion on the pain that is causing, and we can begin to negotiate even plea bargaining for them and kind of get past the fact that someone who is exercising their honorable constitutional rights is being prosecuted for something that they, whoever acted against the law, however noble sentiments that well-meaning they were, it violates the Constitution. There is no current statute. Maybe you guys think there is. You know, I would be my honor and privilege to listen. There's no statute that requires a law that's repugnant to the Constitution and already ruled void by Marbury v. Madison, struck down in a lower court or a higher court. Presently, it is void from the beginning. Marbury v. Madison, 1803, first branch, 179. So what happens is that by asking the question of the prosecutor, I've had questions that I've asked of not just the prosecutors, but of judges, and got a shocking response to the judge. In one case, I was recently notified that 6.5 years after, almost 7 years after I appeared in her court, that she never, ever, ever convicted anyone of no state driver's license, ever again. And she retired December 31st, I'm told, and that in the remainder of her payment for bailiff, I saw at the court, from the court building downtown recently, came over to me and told me that story. He says, you know what, the officers are still, so a lot of them still write him, but a lot of the officers don't write him. We didn't try to put together a brief of all these different cases, court rulings, and lower court rulings, and appellate court sites. We didn't do anything. We just asked some very, very short questions. You know, Your Honor, I'd like to use permission to use the right. You know, and so if I don't have that license, does that mean I can't go to work on Monday or church on Sunday or go to, you know, shopping on Wednesday night or son cuts his foot on a glass bottle on Tuesday night? I can't. Possibility.
Yeah.
And would that be a deprivation of civil rights under color law under 18 U.S.C. 242? Judge, well, wait, the prosecutor's the first objective. But the prosecutor, his friends, judge had more than 112 counts, no state driver's license. Summarily, when I got done, she said, I'm going to dismiss your case. Mean, Your Honor, that you're going to dismiss all the rest in the courtroom today? She says, youngster, you're pushing. She called me youngster. I'm probably 10 or 12 or 14 years older than she was. And she says, you know what? Everybody has got no state driver's license on the ticket. Raise your hand. And two-thirds of the courtroom raised their hand. And there was a couple hundred people in the courtroom. She says, okay, now, that's the only charge you have on your ticket. Stand up and stand up. And about half of those people stood up. So we use their standing hands up, you're over on this side. Those that don't on this other side. She says, I'm going to summarily dismiss the charge. You that have other charges, you're going to. And you have to, you know, stand for that other charge, whatever it was, speeding or whatever it was, you know. But there's no state driver's license. I'm going to just summarily dismiss that. And she says, I'm going to give a 15-minute recess. Michael, do you have a question?
Yeah, what I wanted to do is to, as that crazy redhead in the White House said one time, let's circle back. What I had talked about Nicholas's issues regarding how you had masterfully reduced everything. If you get rid of the court style, you get rid of the certificate of service and prayer and stuff like that, the actual rebuttal was on two pages, and that was double-line spaced. So really, it could all could have fit on one page. But the point being is the purpose of that hearing that day was if there was going to be a railroading, it was going to happen on that day. The judge, because what you produced was as a teaching material, was so brief, the judge actually read it, which is a miracle unto itself, saw multiple red flags that the arrogant prosecutor willfully overlooked and bailed that prosecutor's rear end out of the potential of having to deal with her errors right then and there. And what did he do? He reset the hearing for another day, a month out. And you know there's going to be a lot of discussion. There's going to be a lot of discussion between the bench and the prosecutor, and telling the prosecutor, you damn well better withdraw. Go ahead. Talk about that, please.
Well, did he have reducing something to the lowest common denominator in simple terms, in this case, recognizing constitutional laws is extremely important. And what Michael said is very true. Two of the counts were reduced to less than a paragraph. One of them was only a third of a paragraph. The other was half a paragraph. And double space, two of the felony counts on that didn't even take up a full page. And it was so largely spaced that judge, now, those of you who have any background in your experience, know that, you know, if a motion is going to be weighed, you have to give the other party sufficient time to review it. And there are laws in some states, a motion requires 14 days, depending on what you could say, some criminals, some civil. Some states, in some jurisdictions, some state district courts, it's 3 days. This judge was prepared to walk into courtroom to take this student to task. And when he used, and but when the young student, when they found out that he had filed one with the court clerk, apparently, from what I found out, the judge actually looked to see if there was a motion already in, and his clerk punched it up to his screen for him, and he just thumbing through it that quick, not even having a paper copy, saw what he saw enough that this young student, after Michael and I spent quite a few hours with him, that what this young student ended up submitting it shocked the judge so much that the trial that was going to happen didn't. And he flat out just straight encouraged him to meet with the prosecutor. And the prosecutor says this young man's a very belligerent, unkind citizen. Michael and I may go different. We were actually on the conference call with the prosecutor, and she lied in court. There's a handful of short cases already that what's happened is that just in the last couple of months, we've had situations where something was very simple. We were able to make it candid and succinct and easy for the judge and everybody else to review, and it got reviewed and heard. One justice, current sitting Chief Justice, commented about, well, this was a discussion was about a year ago, but he commented that, John, motions and briefs that are more than 3 to 5 pages long rarely ever get fully read. There just isn't enough time in the day for everybody to read all these. And one thing I found out is that this prosecutor hadn't even fully made herself conversant with what the young gentleman was charged with. And on the call, the conference call, we couldn't ascertain that she understood even the basic statutes under which she and the other prosecutor got the grand jury indictments. So what's happening is that we find ourselves in a situation that if it's short, succinct, and to the point, there's a good chance it may get read, it may get observed. But what happens is that if we get wordy and out of control, what happens is that the news doesn't get read. Even if, regardless of how much, how good you put in there, they may never get to it. So the point we're trying to make this evening is that what's wrong? You know, if you take last week's call and with your concerns about justiciable standing and making a claim for which relief can be granted, and get to the place where you know what you're claiming so that you can ask for the relief that you want, do it very, very simply, then there's a chance you may get that. You may get a response.
Okay.
Go ahead, Mike.
Just to demonstrate how quickly and efficiently less is more is demonstrated in the first count. That's her arms. It took six sentences to get rid of count one. It took one sentence to get rid of count two, and it took two sentences to get rid of count three. You can't boil it down any more than that. That's to its pure essence. So with that having been said, while we still have John, and I'm surprised he's still here, let's open it up for Q&A. Press star 2 on your keypad, ladies and gentlemen. When John's got to go, he's got to go. Press star 2 on your keypad to raise your hand. Otherwise, we'll have a real short call. While you're thinking about pressing star 2 on your keypad, I'm going to go check Freedom's Radio for any questions written up over there. You know, when they tell him to disboard the plane, he's got to go. Press star 2 on your keypad. Nobody at Freedom's Radio has raised their hand. Otherwise, we're going to say an early good night, and that's okay, too. We all got places to go. Okay, Brother Ron out of Coca-Cola, Florida. Go ahead, buddy.
Well, we'll try this for a third time. It has been brought to my attention that when you hire or have the court a court-appointed public defender, that you are declared either an infant or an imbecile.
Yeah. All right, hold it right there, John. Did you notice in the audio recording of what transpired that the attorney not referenced as his counsel? Do you remember that?
Yes. There, something that we've started to address, and there's cases where individuals made pleas, or they've requested special consideration, and what happens is the court rules them incapacitated or incapable, either from because of their ignorance of the law, meaning that they're not a jurisprudent, but that they say that you're not allowed to represent yourself because you're either financially or mentally incompetent. And so what happens is that
The judge rules that he says that he can rule on your behalf. Now, the same documentation that it comes from the same document that gives the judge, this is their authority, that's Article 3, Section 1 of the Constitution, and or Article 3 of the Constitution. In Amendment Number 6, what happens is that it gives you that same document, parallel individuals, side by side, you get the, are given the authority to choose your own counsel. Justices, they don't seem to like to do that. They've got a lot of problems with that. So what happens is that they think. I listened to one of them who I had known since I was his paper boy as a young man, and he told me, he says, John, there's some of these people that there's just nothing, that they don't know what they're doing. And I was tempted to use his name a moment ago, but I was his paper boy back in the 60s. And he says, sometimes there's just nothing else you can do. And I asked him that at one of these, at the 70s, when I was at law at USC in Southern California, I asked him, we had one of these conferences, and he went there, and we had lunch together, and I asked him about whether it was right to invalidate their right, the authority, and at first I said right, and then I changed. You know, and it hit me. It's not their right. It's their attempt to invalidate their authority to choose their own counsel. And he says, well, they don't have it. I says, the same document that gives you your authority to hear a case gives them their authority to choose. It's parallel. It's side by side. This isn't a subordination. This isn't a higher authority over a lower authority or a higher authority over someone that they lord over. It isn't any of that. It says they're side by side. And he looked at me so shocked when I asked him that question. And this is one of the early places where, you know, I learned about asking questions of the judiciary. And coincidentally, this was literally right after I had taken the California bar and passed with the second highest mark in 3 years of anybody that had taken the California bar at the time. And making it as short and sweet as possible, I've got an appellate brief where somebody was not allowed to be their own counsel. It was ruled against him. He was forced. Counsel was forced on him. And, so in the midst of everything, and the judge, what he wants to do, he says, you are not going to get a chance to plead ineffectiveness of counsel. And, so amidst everything that was going on, this gentleman, bench swept this gentleman's rights away, quote unquote, because he didn't want to have an appeal with ineffective counsel. And so what's happening is that right now we're preparing an appeal brief for this gentleman where it's going to be because the judge assigned him a public defender or public pretender or whatever you want to call it. And so recently in the last 3 years, we've learned to ask a lot of questions. And on this one, the question that we're asking is that the same authority that gives you your authority, Your Honor, I have to object. The same authority that gives you your authority to hear this case gives me my authority to choose who I want for counsel. And that's the same document. It's the Constitution. We're side by side. This isn't a subordinate issue to you. I have the same authority. I'm at the same authority level you're at, according to the Constitution. Now, does the Constitution stand and I have the right to choose my own counsel and you have the right to hear this? Or if I don't have the right to choose my own counsel, or whether I want to have counsel or not, then you don't have the right to hear this case, and then I should probably go ahead and leave. So what's happening is that that question asked just that way, we've got one justice who is considered the hanging judge who never let anybody in this in his jurisdiction plead his own case, a criminal defense, has now three in a row, and we haven't actually charged him with federal grand jury criminal indictment yet, and because he's changed his attitude, and so we won him over. So does that help?
Ron,
well, that does, but
I want to thank you, Ron, for bringing that up very much.
Okay, I have a backup question to that.
Okay, Ron, go ahead.
Being that the judge has declared the defendant incompetent, is the judge practicing medicine without a license, being that he is not a psychiatrist or a psychologist?
And then man made God in his own image.
That's a great question,
yeah.
Ron. I'd like to hear that answer.
Yes. Technically, think about it. No matter what happens, no matter how you slice it, the judge does not have the authority to rule anybody incompetent. And if he does, he's colored outside the lines and broke the rules. It's just that simple.
So he can be charged with practicing medicine without a license?
Absolutely. Some people say that, well, judges have implicit judicial immunity and that prosecutors have what's called prosecutorial immunity. Well, Article 3, Section 1, Paragraph 1, Sentence 2 of the Constitution says, justices of the superior courts and the inferior courts shall maintain their status in times of good behavior, meaning that there is zero judicial immunity. And I had a lady that said, and I actually heard a recording of the hearing, but she says, she told the judge, she says, Sonny, you're telling me that you can sweep away my rights and take away my life and that there's nothing I can do about it? And he says, ma'am, you cannot prosecute me for anything. She says, Sonny, I know where you live. I know all the ladies in your neighborhood. He says, when they find out what you just said to me, do you think your life will have one iota of value? She used some colorful metaphors at the time. You know, she used the term worth a rat's ass, you know. But I'm paraphrasing it. This judge says, you can't talk to me like that. She says, you can't talk to me like that. She says, I don't work for you. You work for me. And, excuse me? Thank you. And she says, excuse me. Excuse me, sir. Thank you. Thank you, sir. I But she says, I don't work for you. You work for me. She says, no, I don't. I work for the state. She says, this is a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, Sonny. And she says, you work for me. And if you don't work right, you will get fired. And you will get your hand slapped into the butt spanked. She said, she told him, you'll get your butt spanked. And she says, you know, you see what 15 or 30 ladies like me can do, you know, with somebody like you that's unprotected. That driveway you park in between your garage and your house, that's a long way to get to your, from your driveway to your house. Now, either, now, and she, the judge stepped down. He says, we're going to have a recess. And he left. He resigned that day. He didn't come back. And that was at a little sleepy town in Oregon. Okay? Nothing to do with somebody that we're currently working with. But somebody played me the tape of this lady giving this judge. He was in his early 40s at the time. You know, so he was still kind of a young buck and didn't have a lot of background. But that, she was right. Those judges and justices are our employees. And, you know, like that little joke we told, 4 weeks ago, where the, owner of the factory walked out on the factory floor and found a bunch of his employees sitting down drinking coffee and smoking cigarettes behind a machine. He says, what are you guys doing here? How come you're not working? And one of them looks up at him and says, we didn't know you were watching. Does that help a little bit?
Yes, that does clarify things. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ron. How's your time doing, John? We have one more hand raised. However, it's a hand that's going to ask a lot of questions. Do you have time?
Oh, boy. You know what? Let's go ahead and see if we can take the question.
All righty. Kent, how are you doing tonight?
Okay. Good evening, Mike. Good evening, John. How are you doing?
Good evening, Kent. Doing better than a mortal human being should be more than allowed to be. That's in spite of how much fun we may really be having.
that's a good answer. So I asked a question the other night, which we felt should be directed to you. And it was about the Civil Act right of 1964. And I was saying, if one claims to be an American national and they wouldn't be obligated to pay sales tax, is the fact that the Civil Rights Act covers nationality, and this will be a two-part question, is the fact that the Civil Rights Act covers nationality a reason for exercising that Civil Rights Act against a proprietor in an operation, LLC or otherwise, that refuses to provide service over your questioning their right to charge an American national sales tax? And then I'll ask the second part of that.
Well, what is sales tax? I'm going to ask you a question back. What is sales tax?
Sales tax is a tax put on the purchase of an item and or a service.
Now, what kind of items? Are there certain items that are exempt from sales tax?
Depending on what state you're in, food might be exempt. Certain services might be exempt. Other items might be exempt. If you were a reseller and you put a resale certificate in, might be exempt. A lot of different situations.
You know a single state that taxes milk and eggs?
Well, I'm sure there are some. I don't know what they would be exactly. Many states don't tax milk and eggs.
There may be a state that does that, but to date, I don't yet know of one. I'm not aware of one. And so what happens is that because it's a necessity. You can't tax something that's a necessity. In this case, food. Now, I may lose you guys. I don't know. I'm in an elevator. And so if I lose you, I'll try calling right back. My humble apologies. But in the meantime, I'll keep talking. There's a lot of different kinds of taxes, luxury tax, et cetera. But usually items that are taxed are either for the individuals that are using that particular service, or it's something that is optional. And, you know, like there's gasoline tax. And what it is that it helps fund the roads. And the sales tax, it's true. There's some things that are taxed that shouldn't be. But the tax technically runs the government. And back in the time, in biblical times, Yeshua, you know, when he was there, somebody said, is it rightful to pay taxes to Caesar? You know, you and I have talked about this, and, you know, and somebody, you know, the question he asked was, does anybody have a coin? And he said, yeah, and whose likeness is that on there? And, he says, Caesar's. And so they said, well, he said, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's. And, then later on at one point, there's something called the temple tax. And, you know, yes, your disciples pay the tax. He quietly told Peter, he actually didn't do it quietly. He just told Peter, he says, go get your fishing rod, you know, Opie. And, you're going to catch one fish, there's going to be 2 coins in its mouth. And when you get those 2 coins, then go pay the tax. The tax runs, pays for the government and runs the government, the taxes. It's my perception that, if we don't, there's a certain amount of funding that has to occur to keep the government running and, keep the, traffic lights on and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And if we don't, if we don't fund that, things start to come to a screeching halt. And it's, we all have a responsibility to help keep the government running. And it's the government that theoretically we, of the people, by the people, and for the people. Now, do I have a problem with if the tax isn't paid, do they take away your right to earn a living, or even incarcerate you? That's unconstitutional, and that's an issue for a separate call. But there's a start on that one. It can't come on that.
Okay, so what I would say, with all due respect, is when you say the taxes or certain taxes, maybe a sales tax, runs the government, we have to ask which government. And if we would claim not to be a part of that government, then why would we have any obligation to pay in to run that government? Now, you might argue, and this was also said on the call, if it comes to imposts and duties, then an American national might be obligated to pay that. I've discussed that with somebody else who doesn't necessarily agree with that. You know, I'm sure all of these issues haven't necessarily been tried in a court of law with a final decision by the Supreme Court. But why would an American national want to necessarily contribute to that government which he's claiming or she's claiming not to be a part of? The other interesting thing about what you said, John, is you said it was your perception about these taxes. Well, you know, we all have various perceptions, but that doesn't necessarily make us right or wrong.
Yeah. There's what happens is that I have to apologize. I'm getting on a bus right now between the airplane terminal and the parking. But so I'm going to try not to be rude to my fellow passengers on the bus. But most of the sales taxes, the majority of them, but I think it's 82 or 84% average, fund the local city and county government. There's a 6% that funds the state government, and the remainder goes to federal government. That's to the exclusion of the sales tax on fuel, on gasoline. But they at this juncture, paying those sales taxes. American nationals need the local government. They're what, when somebody comes to shoot up our property and rob us, they're that local government and local law enforcement are the ones that, keep us from getting shot up and keep the ones from, coming out and killing us. So, I think paying local sales tax is a good thing. And to date, there's nothing constitutionally that I can see that it violates that would say that it's not right. Correct me if I'm wrong. Back to you, Kent.
So you don't see the argument of using the civil rights law of 1964 with them not being able to discriminate over nationality as to turning the sales tax and the American national argument into a civil rights issue as far as that business is concerned?
Kent, I'm gonna make two points on that. Number one, I should probably study that act a little bit more before I give you a further response. But the other is that regardless of nationality, the local governments must be kept intact. That's the fabric that holds society together. And to do that, we have to pay, groundskeepers for the parks, the mayors, and the local constabulary, and the individuals that maintain the roads. We have to do that. Otherwise, society would collapse. It appears you see something that I may not.
Okay.
And so I'm gonna put a place card holder in there and say, let me look into that so I can see what you see, and maybe during the week sometime, make an appointment with Michael, and let's you and I tear into this, like a good helping of steak and potatoes, and see. And I want to hear what you see. Thank you.
Okay, and then the other thing
just to mention that the excise tax that you pay when you're at the fuel pump is supposedly directly attributed to the maintenance of the roads and the building of the roads, et cetera. Go ahead, Kent.
Yep. So the other thing that I wanted to raise, John, about this was, the question that came up the other night was, or the further question was, if a business is affected by the Civil Rights Act of 1964, but I am claiming to be an American national, as Michael was saying, well, then you couldn't really use the Civil Rights Act. So the next question that came up was, is there a way, since the business being in commerce would be affected by that 1964 Civil Rights Act, if the argument was good on nationality and the sales tax, how would an American national then use the Civil Rights Act against that business? How would that be turned into a constitutional issue that American national could enforce against that proprietor?
I don't have,
I have to work. I have the right to put food on my table.
Let's make an appointment sometime next week or two, and let's chat about this. I don't feel properly prepared to answer that question.
Okay.
All right.
I appreciate that.
All right.
Just one thing. I have other questions, but I don't know if this is an appropriate time or I should just hold them. So.
Let's bring them up.
You know what?
John is in a place that's not conducive for this, and I'm blessed that we've had him this long tonight.
Okay.
I want to thank everyone for joining us and reminding everyone, please, tomorrow night is Mr. Slevin, about the LLC that can change your life. Trust, it's awesome. John, did you have anything in closing you wanted to say?
For those, all of those in the listening audience, and especially those of you on Freedom Radio, thank you for the honor and the privilege of being able to serve you in some small fashion. I look forward to restoring liberty to America with you, I'll give you one of my little sayings that I
that I share sometimes a couple times a day. Chivalry and consideration for one's fellow person is not dead. But if I can help it, now it may have a second chest wound, but if I can help it, it will not be dead. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for joining us tonight. Until tomorrow night, be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.